Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're very glad to have you listening this morning. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Cal Mabry at the controls this morning. Since 1990, Teach for America has worked to close the achievement gap between the country's richest and poorest students. And it does this by taking some of the nation's top college graduates and, after an intense summer of training, sending them into some of America's most troubled classrooms. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be hearing about some of the experiences of four young teachers assigned by Teach for America to Locke High School in South Los Angeles. And our guest for the program is Donna Foote. She's a freelance journalist and former Newsweek correspondent and author of a recently published book titled Relentless Pursuit, A Year in the Trenches with Teach for America. Knopf is the publisher. As we talk this morning with our guest, questions certainly are welcome. Anybody who is listening can call in. We only ask that people try to keep their comments brief, just so that we can keep our program moving and get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly callers are welcome. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, or maybe you're listening across the country on the internet, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Foote, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very well.
Good. Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Sometimes I think, you know, maybe one of the most remarkable things about Teach for America is that it exists at all. And when you think about particularly that this was the brainchild of one individual, this woman named Wendy Kopp had this idea. I'm sure that a lot of people have a lot of great ideas about things, but they don't end up being realized and you know, as successfully as this. Tell us the story of how it is that Teach for America came to be in the first place.
Well, it is a remarkable story, and it really reminds us of the power of one idea, one person. Wendy Kopp was a senior at Princeton, and organized a conference in San Francisco about education. She was a leader and practically did run their large student magazine. In any event, she has this conference and pulls in a lot of the best and brightest at Princeton and other educators, and in discussing the problems of education, it occurs to her, you know, why don't we have a teaching corps not unlike the Peace Corps? And during the course of this conference, many of her peers had said, yeah, they'd be willing to teach, but they didn't want to go to necessarily be teachers for life or spend 2 years getting a teacher credential, et cetera, et cetera. And so she thought, well, how about this? Why don't we start a teacher corps? She made that her Princeton thesis. She had a very difficult time getting anyone to agree to be her advisor on this, however, finally succeeded in getting Marvin Bressler to sign on board. And basically, the blueprint for Teach for America was right there in her thesis. And by the end of her senior year, she had secured some funding to begin.
The program is very selective, highly selective. More people apply than are accepted. What are the criteria? How do they decide who it is that they're going to take?
Well, Teach for America is looking for leaders, and they've figured out there are certain characteristics of good leaders, or competencies, as they say. One, and probably the most important, is a record of achievement. So they are looking for college graduates who have achieved high GPAs, successfully started organizations or led organizations, that kind of clear sense of leadership. Perseverance, big. They really value the person who is not stopped by obstacles, who continues on and remains in relentless pursuit, hence the title of my book. The other thing is critical thinking, someone who can approach a problem and think it through and come up with creative solutions. Organization skills, any teacher out there knows you have to be organized. The other characteristics are the ability to influence and motivate people, not only students, but parents and staff. Finally, respect for the students and the community in which you're going to serve, and this kind of idea that you agree, they call it fit, but the idea that you absolutely agree with the mission, which is that every child deserves the opportunity to achieve a good education. Mm-hmm. So those are the competencies they look for, and they very carefully grade and scale each applicant according to those seven requirements or competencies.
And what percentage of those that are accepted as their undergraduate major in college were education majors? Do many of these people, did they go to college, did they graduate from college with the intention of being teachers?
Very, very few of them. Very few of them. And it's not something that Teach for America looks for. It's not necessarily the education majors. What they're looking for are leaders. Teach for America has a two-pronged theory of change. And in the short term, the idea is that they will get the very smartest, brightest, most committed, most energetic young leaders, potential leaders, to spend 2 years in the classroom. Then the idea is that they will be so transformed by this experience that it will be such a life-changing 2 years that no matter what they do, whether they become lawyers or doctors or journalists or policymakers, they will be then committed to closing the appalling achievement gap between our most privileged and most impoverished kids.
And thus, I suppose that points to what, for people who want to find something to criticize about Teach for America, it is a point of criticism, that is, that it's a temporary commitment.
Yep.
and that I'm sure that some people who go through Teach for America do indeed decide to continue to be teachers, but a lot of people don't. And so I suppose some people say that that's a weakness, the fact that there's always going to be this huge turnover. And in fact, you know, who knows, maybe you've got somebody who could possibly be a really great teacher, and for whatever reason, they don't continue to teach. Within Teach for America, how do they talk about that fact, that it is indeed only a two-year deal?
Yes. Well, it is a criticism, and it is a valid one. And in a school like Locke, where I was, there is, you know, a lot of teacher turnover, and so the thinking is, you know, you bring these kids in, then it just exacerbates an already critical problem. Having said that, teachers all over America, no matter where they're teaching, are bailing big time. And so while it may be true that Teach for America teachers are leaving, so are the rest of them. A third of all of the new teachers leave within 3 years, and half are gone within 5 years. So it is, you know, yes, that is a problem, but I think we really have to think about retention, and especially about this new generation. It might be that nobody's going to stay in education as long as it is structured the way it is now, or even maybe Generation Y are just not career, you know, keepers. Maybe they're going to have 2, 3, 4, 5 careers in their lifetime, and why shouldn't they? So it is a valid criticism. Having said that, it's across the board a problem in American education. We don't train, select, retain, promote, nourish our teachers, and so they leave.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Donna Foote. She's a freelance journalist, former Newsweek correspondent, and is the author of the book Relentless Pursuit, A Year in the Trenches with Teach for America. The book is published by Knopf, and it is about her experiences following along a group of four young people, college graduates, who go into Teach for America, and it's about their first year, their experience teaching in this high school in Los Angeles. Questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, just to talk a little bit more about what happens before these teachers get to the classroom, that Teach for America now has these people, they've selected them, and they're bright, and they're capable, and they're highly motivated, and they have a lot of great skills, but they have not been prepped to be teachers. How do you take somebody like that and give them a crash course? I think people talk about it in boot camp. That's the metaphor they use.
Yeah.
A crash course to get them ready to teach, and not just ready to teach, but to go into a classroom where even a very experienced teacher would be really challenged.
Right. And that, too, is another criticism. If we really wanted to change the achievement gap, does it make sense to send our least experienced teachers into our most challenging classrooms? Again, I mean, the boot camp is very, very intense. Thank God I didn't actually have to do the work, because it really was, you know, get up at 5 a.m. in the morning, and some of the recruits probably didn't. Some of them never went to bed, it seemed, but certainly they were up quite late, lesson planning. And you know what? The teachers that I followed struggled mightily, especially in the first half of the year. And no getting around it. It is tough. But I have to also say that come springtime, you know, big changes. You could see that both the teachers and the students were making some pretty dramatic gains. So, you know, it's a tough one. It does seem like a very short, abbreviated time to be training for something as serious as this. Having said that, it's very condensed, but it's very targeted. You don't have a lot of teachers and educators themselves complain about the irrelevancy of some of the curriculum in our more structured and established teacher education programs. And a lot of that is left aside, and it's a very focused training session. Having said that, I don't know. Is anyone ever prepared for an inner city classroom? I'm not sure.
Probably not. I don't know how you could be.
Yeah. No, it's tough. It was very difficult for the Teach for America recruits. Absolutely.
And some even, I suppose it's also true that the prep experience, the boot camp experience, for some people it's so tough they don't even make it through that. They
right.
say part of the way through is say, well, I can't do this, and you lose them. So I suppose do they look at it as being a way of trying to weed out people who don't have the commitment or who aren't going to be strong enough?
Well, I think the hope is that they've already figured out that their selection process is amazingly almost scientific. It's very data-driven. They have, over the years, been able to correlate which traits it is in their best teachers that produces the best results in children. And so they're very focused in terms of making sure that they're picking the right people. And hence you have, 12% of the graduating class at Yale applying, and maybe a third of them actually being accepted. You know, they're very, very selective. So the hope is that they've got it right from the beginning. But having said that, for the teacher who is struggling and is not sure that, you know, this is a good fit for them, Teach for America wants to weed them out before school begins, because it's very damaging to the students, to the organization, to future placements if Teach for America is placing teachers in schools who then decide that they can't make it halfway through the year. And that happened in the book, actually. It was a very traumatic thing for everyone involved when one of their best recruits decided that in December that he just couldn't take it anymore. It created a lot of controversy, bad feelings at the school, and, it's something that Teach for America doesn't want to happen. So they're very, very clear on the front end that they need to get kids or teachers that are going to stick with it and never give up.
Mm. Well, tell us about the place. What is Locke High School like?
Oh, Locke High School is actually right now and has been taken over by the Green Dot Charter Organization. And so it's definitely in transition, and we'll see. Green Dot is hoping to transform this big, badly performing school into a great school, against all odds, I must say. Locke is situated in a very bad neighborhood, surrounded by warring gangs. It was built in the spirit of hope after the Watts riots, because that whole area in South L.A. was destroyed. And so here came this beautiful, new, fabulous school in 1967, and for a few years it looked like it was going to do the job. But quickly things degenerated, and by the time I was at Locke, I'll tell you the story that really got me interested in exploring the issues at Locke more deeply was a friend of mine was teaching, first-year teacher, and she asked me, she said she was really struggling, and she had gone through a regular credentialing program, and she just needed help. So I said, sure, I'll come in, and I went into her classroom, and it was ninth grade, and there was Liza standing at the front of the room with her hand held high in the air saying, "K-at, cat." And there were, and the ninth graders were enunciating right behind her. And after 50 minutes, it was very clear to me that these kids couldn't read. I mean, it wasn't like they couldn't read at all. They couldn't sound out these words. And they were not special ed kids. These were in the regular, you know, school population. So that's the kind of school Locke is. 2% of the kids are proficient in algebra, 2%. And here's another statistic, not to bog you down, but this is another one that sort of propelled my reporting. In 2001, 1,000 kids entered the freshman class. In 2005, the year I was there to watch the graduation, 240 graduated. And of those 240, get this, 30 were actually eligible to apply to a California State University. So that's 3% of the kids that started at Locke High School actually got what they needed. You know, I don't know. I just find that so shocking and appalling and sad.
For those young people that the Teach for America teachers that you followed here, in the book, you learn about them, you learn about their backgrounds. Was there anything in their backgrounds that would have prepared them to go into a classroom like this, or would this for them have been a major kind of for all of them, was this a major kind of a culture shock?
I would say for three of them, it was a major culture shock, but for Philip Gideon, who was raised in Springfield, Massachusetts by a single black mother, and who himself had struggled. Even for him, I have to say, he was much more comfortable than they were at first. But even he never encountered, because he had a stable home life, albeit not a father in the house every day, but his mother kept him inside and kept him on track, and he was very determined from a very young age to become a teacher, actually. So he wasn't as shocked, but I would say that definitely the other three had never really encountered anything like this. But then who does?
What if, and maybe I don't know how much you can go into talking a little bit about these four young people and what motivated them. But if you can, say a little bit more about them, and if it's possible, something about what it was that moved them to apply for the program.
Well, I think Teach for America, again, its recruitment is very very sophisticated. And one of the reasons why I think it's been so successful is it taps into a youthful sense of idealism, which I think we all share at 21, but also the elitism, the idea that many are called, few are chosen. Teach for America has set itself up as this very, very elite core. And so the idea that was very appealing to this type of student they want, the one who has been competing for good grades and good schools all their lives. So I think that played into it, but also this is a generation that has been committed to community service from a fairly young age. A lot of them, even in high school, as a requirement of graduation, had to do some community service. So I think there was some of that, this idea that, you know, this is what we do as good citizens of the world. And then finally, none of the four had law school or business school or medical school in their immediate future. And so here was a way to give back short term, do something really good, and have a lot of responsibility very early on, but also not get off track, because Teach for America has very carefully built these partnerships with law street firms and graduate schools, and so that if you do decide to do Teach for America, you will get a deferment. But it also does look good on your resume when you leave. It is considered a plus, a very, very positive thing to have done. So there was that too. I think less of that, the idea that this was a resume builder, but certainly there was the idea that there was nothing to lose in terms of your career and staying on track.
All right. We have a caller here, someone to join in the conversation. Others certainly are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here is a caller where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, Lee. I know you spoke a little bit about the training that these teachers get when they're brought into the schools, and that it's kind of a crash course situation. And I've seen more and more of that when it comes to youth programming and dealing with youth, that the training aspect is something that maybe it's not something that people could forget, but it's something that may be cut back a little bit. I'm wondering how these teachers are supported once they go into the school. So can you talk a little bit about the support mechanisms that are there to
right.
do bridge and work through problems and
yes.
kind of cope with their situations? And I'll take it offline. Thanks.
There is a support network set up. Teach for America has a lot of acronyms, and one of them is Program Director. And the Program Director, the PD, is assigned, I don't know, anywhere from 20 to, the year I was there, 50, but I know they've cut it back, teachers to watch. And so they make probably 4, 5, 6 visits to the classroom to observe, and then they sit down with the teacher and go over what the problems are and sort of problem solve together and strategize. In addition to that, all of the teachers are required, at least in California, and I think all across the nation, actually, under No Child Left Behind, to be highly qualified. So that means they have to be working towards a credential. So all of the students, teachers, that is, go to night school, most of them to get their master's, but at the very least to be credentialed. Then in addition to that, depending on the school to which you're assigned, there is usually mentoring within the school. And finally, what Teach for America tries to, and in addition to that, Teach for America requires Saturday classes for their teachers. And then finally, they try and cluster their teachers together so that they have a support system right there. And, you know, they can walk down the hall and ask the teacher who was in their position a year ago, how did you deal with this? So they recognize that that's a very big part of success in the classroom is making sure that these teachers are supported. And I think sometimes it works better than others.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You read the stories in here, and it's just kind of heartbreaking, or at least your heart goes out to these students when you see just how tough a time they had in the classroom. And first of all, dealing with the teachers, dealing with students that had incredible educational deficits for their age. You know what kind of backgrounds, you have some sense what kind of backgrounds they come from. But not only dealing just with their deficits, but also just getting their attention, having some order in the classroom, you know, getting them to take the institution that clearly had not served them well for probably all of their lives, getting them to take that seriously. You know, they've shown up, but in some cases, that's pretty much all they've done is they've they've shown up. How, and to, not just to deal with one of those things, but to try to deal with all of those things at the same time. I think it's a marvel that that these young teachers actually continue to show up day after day.
Yeah, well, I think the real heroes are the kids who show up, to be honest, because it is true that some of these, you know, it's amazing. Some of these kids have to travel through different gang territories. They have to be aware of you know, what they're wearing and what they say and how they look. And I mean, just getting to school for some of them is a real triumph. So you can imagine, yeah, it is. I think all of my teachers had moments of despair almost, because the things that we ask of our teachers are just kind of amazing. I mean, not only are they supposed to be able to instruct and you know, instruct, educate, but they're supposed to be the ones who can motivate, and sometimes you have to be you know, a psychologist, another time you have to be a coach, other times you have to be you know, a friend. You know, the Teach for America teachers were driving kids home. Rochelle went shopping for one kid's mother who was having chemo. You know, it really, I think all of a very good teacher does all of these things, has all these hats that they put on, and it is overwhelming sometimes. Again, I said, you know, they all struggled mightily and really had second thoughts about whether or not they had done the right thing. And eventually, I think they came to understand that what they feel that what they had done was, you know, quite amazing and probably the most important thing that they would ever do.
Well, what do you think was the big you talked about the fact that there was one of them that halfway through said, I can't do this.
Right.
What makes the difference between that the person who said halfway through, look, I can't do this, and the other three who somehow did manage to tell themselves, yes, I think I can do this, and they kept going?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. The other three said there was just no way that they could ever quit. You know, that was, you know, it was just not an option for them. They and that was just sort of their character, I think. And having said that, I mean, Dave, the teacher that did leave, had an unbelievable load. He was teaching five different preps, they call it. So he had to prepare for five different classes. You know, it was unbelievable, and everyone perfectly understood why he would leave. But most of them just said, as much as they would like to, It was something that was not even, they couldn't even contemplate it, because that's not who they were.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint here of this hour of focus. Again, our guest is Donna Foote. She is a freelance journalist and a former Newsweek correspondent. She's author of the book Relentless Pursuit. The subtitle is A Year in the Trenches with Teach for America. It's published by Knopf, and it follows the experiences of four young people who were recruited into Teach for America and then were sent to teach at a high school in South L.A., Locke High School in South Los Angeles. I'm sure you can find the book in the bookstore if you'd like to read it, and other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What did the other teachers, the career teachers who were there at Locke, what did they think about the Teach for America teachers?
Very divided, and almost generational. For the most part, the older, real entrenched teachers resented Teach for America and said that it contributed to teacher churning, that, you know, they were so energetic, they were so, you know, so smart, and, you know, they were naive. And actually, at the end of the day, by being there and then leaving, they did more harm. Having said that, there was another whole cohort of usually younger teachers who felt aligned with the Teach for America approach and were very dedicated. And so you sort of had this generational gap, I think, at a place like Locke. But on a one-to-one basis, very interesting. I think all of the teachers made an effort to get to know the Teach for America teachers personally. And when they did, it was usually, it's hard not to like them. They're very smart. They're very earnest. If anything, there may be some a little bit of hubris and, you know, smarty pants about them. But for the most part, they're very energetic, and I have to say I was very impressed by every single one of the recruits I met. Mm. You know?
It seems that there are so many stories here of it seems that the teachers and the students are in some of the students are engaged in a kind of a power struggle.
Yeah. But
who is going to be in control in the classroom? And I'm not exactly sure how that gets resolved. How did they just that very issue? I suppose, and there are a lot of classrooms where the very least what the teacher could expect is they're going to go to the head of the classroom, and then the kids are going to mostly give them their attention. At least they're going to sit there, and they're not going to be disruptive. But if you have a classroom where you have one or more who seem to be intent on being disruptive, and it's all about, you know, who's going to be in control and the power struggle, and it's like you tell me to sit down and be quiet. Well, you can forget that. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
How did they approach just that very basic kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, that. The issue of classroom management is key, and I think every teacher knows that. And the teachers that did the best and got there the soonest were the ones who came in and actually were able to establish that classroom control very early on. And the ones that struggled longer had more difficulty with that. And again, that's almost a personality thing, but Philip, for instance, the black geometry teacher was tough. And, I mean, he just laid the law down. For the first week of school, he didn't do anything but really, I'm in charge here, and these are my rules, and if you don't obey my rules, you're out. And by the second day, he was throwing people out of his classroom who had not obeyed. And, you know, really, 2 weeks into the school year, Philip had everybody's attention. Taylor, too, who taught English in ninth grade, came in very, very tough, and she changed her classroom management style as the year went on. As soon as she got the kids' respect, she actually was able to let up a little bit. And but in the early days, boom, you were out of there. You looked at her cross-eyed, you were gone. And, you know, she had great success. Some of the others, having said that, everyone... You know, you encounter these kids who do seem really intent on disrupting class, not interested, and lots of times there are outside circumstances that are causing that kind of behavior. But every single one of them met kids that they just couldn't control, and so those are the kids that you have to make sure they leave the classroom so that the rest of the class can learn. And eventually, I think everybody sort of got that. Drill down, but classroom management is key.
Yeah.
Key.
Were there points where any of them actually felt threatened? That felt physically threatened, like their safety was at stake?
No, I don't think that anyone ever felt physically threatened. There was always on a campus like Locke. There's you know, the violence sometimes jumps the fence. So there were a couple times in which guns were found on campus. There was one time in the Summer Institute when, thank goodness, a student told one of the staff that a boy had come to school with a shotgun, and it was in a guitar case. And they went classroom to classroom, and sure enough, here's this very quiet young man listening intently, and by his side is a guitar case with a shotgun. So there was that sense, and especially during lunch hours, you could tell that things could go one way or the other. But there never was. I didn't see it, and I don't think there was ever the feeling that the students would actually hurt a teacher. Having said that, Harag, who taught biology, did get in the middle of a fight and found himself being punched. You know. Not intentionally, but he did get hurt.
What was the policy? What were they told to do if there was a situation like that? Or indeed, when it came to discipline generally, were they really given advice on what to do? No.
Well, Teach for America, you know, didn't really dwell on that so much. That really is a school-by-school issue normally. But across the state, I think the idea is you never touch a child, and you know, you get help, and if there are two kids fighting, they both go to the office. You know, there are some pretty standard. However, very rarely, if at all, is that communicated to new teachers in a big school like Locke, where there's so much going on, and there are so many 911s, as the principal used to refer to them. So the Teach for America teachers really had no idea what to do in these situations, but you know, I think for the most part handled them pretty well. But it's not communicated. Like at a school like Locke, there's a lot of lockdowns too, and in fact, the first one happened on the very first day of the of a full day of school, and the Teach for America teachers didn't have a clue. They didn't know what to do, except you know when they were not the knock on the door came and the administrator said keep them in your classroom, but they hadn't really been told what school policy was, so it was kind of scary.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus. I'd just like to introduce again our guest for anybody who might have just tuned in, Donna Foote. She is a freelance journalist and a former correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She makes her home in California. She's the author of the recent book Relentless Pursuit, A Year in the Trenches with Teach for America. It's published by Knopf and follows four Teach for America students and their first year at Locke High School in South Los Angeles. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As the students went along, was it the case that if they had a breakthrough, there was a kind of a breakthrough moment? There was something when it almost seemed like the lights just went on, or was it more a case of, if there was progress, it was slow and kind of steady and a little bit and a little bit and a little bit?
Yeah, I don't think there were. There may have been moments, but I think for the most part it was more, as you described, a steady thing. There, Teach for America refers to an article that was written some time ago about the course of a first-year teacher, and it's all pretty predictable whether or not whatever path you take to the classroom, and you know it starts out very idealistic, and pretty soon, within days, you're underwater. It's survival. This is in any classroom, and then you go through a very dark period, usually until Christmas time. Then after that break, you know, the light begins to enter your world, and finally, by spring, things are kind of happening and in order, and then you gradually end the year, and the cycle begins again. So I would say all four of the teachers that I followed by February, March were feeling like, whoa, I can do this. It's hard, but now I can see that I can be effective. Till then, certainly over the Christmas period, I think everybody felt, what did I get into?
Mm-hmm. As they were going along, what sort of evaluation and did the TFA staff offer, and did they come into the classrooms, observe the teachers, see what was going on, and then offer anything in the way of suggestions, help, saying, here, I think you're doing well with this, but maybe you might try doing that, and you know, giving them some kind of guidance, something that they could use that maybe would make things go a little bit better.
Right. Well, the year I was there, Teach for America, the PD was a fellow called Samir Bolar, who was brilliant. Guy, and he struggled too to try and help his teachers, because the year that I was there, Teach for America had a support system called co-investigation, and the idea was that the PD would go into the classroom, observe, take notes, and before he even came, the teacher himself or herself would have done a self-evaluation. These are the areas where I need help, and I'm not doing very well. And would also at the same time have collected data on their students' progress, because the Teach for America approach is outcome-based. They want to know whether students are achieving, not whether or not not if the teacher thinks they're doing well and things are, but they want concrete evidence that, that you are making gains in the classroom. And so the PD would come in having seen the stats and would observe, make his notes, and then they would meet afterwards. And during that year, the idea would be that that the Teach for America teacher would be empowered to figure out the problem, his problem or her problem, that was impeding student progress. And the idea was never that it was the student's fault or the parent's fault or any of the environmental factors that can impact learning. The idea was, what can I do in my classroom to make them achieve academic gains? And if they're not, what am I doing wrong? So each Teach for America recruit was encouraged to discover a key problem that was impeding progress. And this was very difficult, not only for the students, but also for Samir, who didn't really believe that that was necessarily what they needed at that point. He, having been a teacher himself, had thought much better to go in there and say, here, this looks like a problem, why don't you try this? And it was desperately what the recruits wanted, but it wasn't the approach that Teach for America thought would be most effective.
And we were talking a little earlier about the fact that establishing order in the classroom was maybe one of the most important things and the first things that you had to do. And there was there definitely were power struggles going on between individual students and the teachers. Were there also other cases where students took to the teachers so well, in fact, that that was almost a problem?
You know, definitely the all these teachers bonded with their kids, in you know, some more than others. But I don't know that it would be a problem. But I think they kind of fell in love with their students, as most teachers I think do, and so they felt tremendously responsible, and that became a problem for them in a way, because they could never leave the classroom. They could go home on the weekends, but they couldn't stop thinking about what they had done wrong or what more they could do. And, you know, they all went home on Christmas and they found themselves thinking, what is Shaquille doing? And is are they having Christmas, or is there anyone there to give them presents? And so I think that was, it's hard. They're very young too, and almost the same age as these students that they're teaching. So there was that kind of very age-wise identification with their kids. And so, yeah, there were a couple times when, at one point, Harag in his summer school, one of the young girls came up to him at the end of the session and gave him a kiss on the cheek. And he didn't think twice. He kissed her back and then was horrified. He was, oh, my God, I'm a teacher. I can't be kissing her on the cheek. And so there was that kind of stuff, like, oh, where do I draw the line? I want to be their friends, but I'm the teacher, but I really feel like they should call me by my first name because I'm only 4 years older, you know, or 8 years older, whatever.
Well,
so there was that, yeah.
Yeah, I just think about the how they must how the teachers must understand that that these kids have to date have had a rough life,
yeah.
And that if they have a lot of problems, that's not necessarily their fault. And so I imagine as a teacher, you really, you know, it's your impulse not just to try to teach them, but you know, you start thinking, as you say, you start thinking about the other aspects of their lives, and maybe somehow in your heart of hearts wish that you could do something when you recognize, well, of course I can, you know, there's only so much that you can do.
Right. Well, there was at Christmas time, Rochelle, who was a special ed biology teacher, the last day of school before the break, a young girl came in and she wanted to use Rochelle's telephone, and Rochelle asked why. Well, it turns out that she was had just been kicked out of her foster home. She was pregnant, and her foster mother had told her to find a new place to stay because the only place she was welcome would be on the porch outside. And so this poor girl, had all her earthly belongings in a black plastic bag and came to Rochelle's classroom on the last day before Christmas, madly dialing numbers that she believed may have been relatives. And, of course, she got through to no one, and Rochelle didn't know whether that was because they didn't want to take a call from this young girl or what. But in any event, she was desperate. She went down to the principal. It was a Christmas party, and he said, oh, well, you know, go to the social worker. And the social worker helped, but they couldn't find this young girl's caseworker because she was on Christmas lunch. And anyway, long story short, Rochelle stays till 6 o'clock, and she herself has to go home. And there is no place to put this girl. And Rochelle briefly, the girl begs her to adopt her. Mm-hmm. And Rochelle, for, you know, briefly considers, could I adopt her? Could I take care of her? And then, of course, realizes that she can't. At the end of the day, the cops came, took the child away. Rochelle pressed her telephone number into the palm of the child's hand. No one ever heard from her again. Hmm. They couldn't track her. She has no idea what happened to this kid. But you can imagine that it's not a happy ending.
We coming down to the point here, we have about 4 or 5 minutes left. We talked earlier about the fact that one of the criticisms of Teach for America is that it is a temporary thing. It's a 2-year commitment. And we all talked about the fact that of these 4 students that you followed, these 4 teachers you followed, one of them halfway through just said, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do this. It's just too much. And that was, given the workload, that was pretty understandable. So though then after the 2 years, did any of them come out of that saying, you know, I think I want to keep going here. Maybe I want to be a teacher and I want to go beyond this 2-year commitment.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The fellow that dropped out was, you know, in their team, but he was not one that I closely followed. Okay. The 4 that I followed are all still in education, and that's sort of the idea that Teach for America, the second prong of the theory of change, is that they'll be bitten by the bug. And one of them, Harag, is starting a charter school next September. Another one, Rochelle, is still at Locke High School. A third is teaching at a charter school, and Philip is department chair at a big LAUSD public school. So interestingly, although Teach for America is criticized for the fact that it's a short in and out of the classroom, the 4 that I chose randomly to follow are still in education and intend to remain in education. They want to change the system.
And that's not typical, is it?
It's not. I mean, more leave than don't. But we are just beginning to see. I think if to the extent that Teach for America is going to be successful, it will be by what happens to the people that go into the program, leave the classroom, and then make changes. And the KIPP charter schools, I don't know how many of your listeners are aware of them, but they were started by, there's 57 of them, and they were started by 2 Teach for America alumni, and they're now regarded as the model for how to change urban city education and lift achievement scores of the most impoverished kids. And the other big mover and shaker is Michelle Rhee, who is now D.C. Schools Chancellor, a Teach for America alum. She is shaking that poorly performing district by its foundation. And within a year, there have been amazing strides in student gains. So this is what Teach for America is hoping, is that they've embedded society with these leaders who will, as they come of age, will begin to really take charge and lead the effort to reform a system that is clearly broken. And that's where the hope lies with Teach for America, I think. You know, it's true, what can 2 years do if your core is only 3,500 teachers among 3.5 million? You know, you can change a couple of lives. But if these alumni go out and do stick with this cause and embrace it and demand and lead the change, you know, then it's a completely different story. Then it really is a systemic changing movement in education, yeah, which is what we need.
We have just about a minute. This is not enough for this question, but I'm curious because we talked about the fact that the school that you looked at, Locke High, is going to be a charter. It's been taken over by a charter school organization. Mm-hmm. And it seemed that for some time now within school reform, sort of the magic bullet has been the charter school. Mm-hmm. And there's maybe some question about, you know, obviously there are some charters that are great schools and maybe some that aren't.
Right.
Generally, is that what you just have to say? Well, if you ask how – is that a major improvement, you just have to say, well, what school are you talking about?
I think you have to say what school are you talking about. But certainly, you know, there has been some great successes among the charter schools, and I think they offer models, and they also offer hope. Certainly with the KIPP schools, and you're seeing this with Green Dot in L.A., they have proven, and this is really important, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that children that we regard as unteachable are, in fact, teachable. This given a certain set of parameters, these children can achieve at exactly the same rates as their wealthy peers. And that's something that people have doubted. And I think some educators have even said because the problems that they come, the places they come from and the problems they bring with them into the classroom, achievement is almost impossible. Well, that's not true. You know, you can compensate or not compensate, but you can certainly get student gains from students against all odds who you know, have come to school with incredible obstacles to learning.
Yeah. Our guest, Donna Foote, is a freelance journalist, former Newsweek correspondent. She's the author of the book Relentless Pursuit, A Year in the Trenches with Teach for America. It's published by Knopf. Ms. Foote, thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.